International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. Just very quickly mention that tomorrow morning in the first hour, we'll be talking about third-party politics in America with Micah Sifry, former editor of The Nation, senior analyst at Public Campaign, author of a book that came out a number of years ago about third-party politics in this country titled Spoiling for a Fight. That'll be tomorrow morning at 10. Also at 11, talking about corrections in America with Alan Elsner. He is national correspondent for the Reuters News Agency, author of the book Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week, and always give you the opportunity to call in with questions and comments. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Rashid Khalidi. He is one of this country's best known authorities on the Middle East and its history. He is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. Before that, for a number of years, he was Professor of Middle East History and Director of the Center for International Studies at University of Chicago. He has written many articles and a number of books about the Middle East. His most recent is titled Resurrecting Empire. The subtitle is Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. It's published by the Beacon Press, in which he makes the argument that the United States is at risk of stepping into the shoes of previous empires, seen as colonialist, imperialist, in their involvement in the Middle East, which is something that has caused great suspicion and resentment among people of the Middle East now and going back a long time. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, that's the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to call in, please do that. Just please do also bear in mind that we may well have a lot of callers, and it will help us if people are brief in their comments, just so we can keep the program moving and get in as many as people as possible. Professor Khalidi, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. You make the argument that when you look at the involvement of the United States in the Middle East and the way people think about the United States, when you look at that, there's a major kind of dividing line here, which happens to be around the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War.
Right.
That the people in the Middle East, generally speaking, had a pretty favorable attitude towards the U.S. up until the Cold War.
Right.
And that before that, the United States had been much less interventionist than, say, Britain or France. And in fact, in you write in the book that it was seen as a non-colonial or even an anti-colonial power.
Absolutely.
So maybe we could talk a little bit first about U.S. involvement in the region, say, before that period, say, before World War II.
Right.
And then contrast that with involvement after World War II.
Well, before and even into the early, before World War II and even into the early Cold War period, the United States was seen as an anti-colonial power. It's philanthropy and educational and health efforts were unlinked to imperial designs, which was always the case with the European powers. In other words, when they would do something, it was clear that they had ulterior motives. That wasn't the case for the United States. And indeed, President Wilson's 14 points in 1918 were seen as a great boost to the idea of self-determination in the Middle East as elsewhere. And the Middle East, the United States was so positively regarded that when President Wilson sent out a commission of inquiry in 1919, all the people who were asked said, or the majority of them said, we want the United States as a mandatory power. That continued into the early post-World War II period, with the United States helping to get Soviet and British troops out of Iran in 1945-46, with the United States helping Egypt to get the British out in 54, to get the British out of Libya in 1950, to get the French out of Algeria in 1962. So even into the Cold War, the United States still retained some of its positive image as an anti-colonial power.
Hmm. Well, what happened then to change that in the period after World War II?
Well, partly it was the Cold War and the Cold War drive for bases, but that in and of itself, I don't think was the major factor. I think it more importantly was an increasing tendency to of the United States to align itself with regimes that gave the United States either access to oil or strategic advantage or bases, and that was often without reference to whether these regimes were democratic or respected human rights. And in fact, I argue in the book that the United States unfortunately continued a tradition begun by the British and French of undermining democracy in many Middle Eastern countries where, contrary to people's beliefs, there were strong democratic movements or tendencies, and in some cases constitutions and parliaments. And the most egregious example of that was the overthrow of the constitutional parliamentary elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953 by a CIA MI6-led coup, which installed the dictatorship of the Shah and ended constitutional government in that country, which had been struggling for many, many decades against British and Russian interference, and now suddenly the United States joined in. So I think that that's really what began the shift.
Mm. And that, of course, it went on to have implications for the United States after the Iranian Revolution.
Precisely.
And that was something that it seems, I think it's a good thing to remind Americans that perhaps our memories sometimes are short and that people who live in places where we have been involved, their memories are much longer, so that what happened when the hostage crisis came, people in the United States were asking, well, why are they so upset with us?
Yeah, exactly.
We had forgotten what happened in 1953. They had not.
Exactly. In fact, they lived with the consequences of it in the form of the Shah's dictatorship for the next 15 or 16 years. And so they became very bitter about it. Of course, Americans, if they were paying attention in 53, forgot about it very soon afterwards.
Mm.
And that's unfortunately the case throughout the region. We, you know, assume that the colonial period is ancient history. Any grown adult of 50 or 45 or 60 or whatever in the region can remember a time when colonial troops were kicking down doors in Algiers or Aden or wherever as late as the 1960s. So it's not ancient history that the colonial powers, the European colonial powers, were still in this region trying to hold on to bases. And it's not ancient history that the United States has either propped up dictatorial regimes or, in the case of Iran, actually brought a constitutional regime to an end.
Mm. I think it might be useful just to underscore a point that you've touched on and you certainly make in the book. And it's important, I think, because of some of the things that President Bush has said as he has tried to explain why it is that the United States should come in for so much hatred from the region.
Mm-hmm.
He says things like, well, you know, they hate us because of our freedom.
Right.
And what seems to be very striking is that if you look back, particularly at this period before the Second World War, that one of the things that people in the region seemed really to admire about the United States and aspire to was democracy.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is the great paradox of this argument that some people in the administration, including, unfortunately, the president himself, make, which is, in fact, they like us for our values, both our political values, the idea of a rule of law, the idea of a constitution, democracy, and other of our values. Most people in the Middle East really quite like the free market system. Most people in the Middle East like our educational system. Many of our cultural values, including some of them that we may not think of necessarily positively, from MTV to fashion to other things, movies, people in the Middle East love those things. So they don't really dislike our values. They feel that we're not always... our actions are not always in keeping with our values, but they actually do, by and large, like our values. Some of them they may disagree with, but I think the overwhelming majority of people in that region are extremely positive as far as our values are concerned.
The Bush administration, along the course of time, gave a number of reasons for the intervention in Iraq. Some of them seem to have fallen away now. The one that we're still with is the idea of promoting democracy in Iraq, and then somehow that we have this expectation that it's going to set the stage for democratic spread of democracy throughout
mm-hmm.
the region. Now, you do also, though, raise another interesting question in here, and that is, what if democratic governments did come to power in the Gulf states? Would we be happy about it, particularly if they did something like asking the United States to remove all of its troops and bases from the region?
Exactly. Exactly. I seriously doubt that independent democratic governments in places like Qatar, Bahrain, the Emirates, and Oman, would necessarily want American bases. And if they didn't, I wonder what the reaction in the Pentagon would be. I mean, I think we can guess from the kind of contempt for Turkish democracy that the same people in the Pentagon who claim that they're fervent advocates of democracy showed when a democratically elected Turkish parliament overwhelmingly rejected the idea of involvement in the war. I mean, they treated this as if it was some kind of insubordination, whereas it was the action of a democratic parliament that decided that Turkey's national interests did not lie with the war in Iraq. So I think there's good reason for assuming that, and we can see, I think, in Iraq a number of examples of this. Good reason for assuming that really democratic government that really represented the will of the people might not be doing things that some of these fellows want.
Hmm. I have some callers, and I want to promise these people I won't make them wait too much longer. Let me just ask one other question, and then we may get into some other issues and some of these things in greater depth. Setting aside the question of whether democracy in Iraq was indeed a serious goal of the Bush administration, let's take it at face value that it was, and considering past history in the region, not only of American involvement, but of other Western powers, looking at where we are now, what we've done, the way the administration has gone about it, do you think that it is likely that the path we seem to be on now is going to actually achieve the goal of democracy in Iraq?
I mean, I'm not totally pessimistic about the prospects for democracy in Iraq. But I have to say, as a general rule, democracy does not grow out of the barrel of a gun or an occupation. The Japanese and German occupations are not, in fact, counterexamples. Japan and Germany were two of the most advanced economies in world history and had lengthy constitutional histories before the American Allied occupations of 1945. And in both cases, those were internationally mandated, fully legitimate international occupations that were accepted by those peoples. And as I say, they had a basis of hugely developed economies and lengthy experience with constitutions. So I don't think that occupations or force are ways to bring about democracy. It just doesn't happen that way, A. And B, I think that what has happened during the 13 months of our occupation have guaranteed that if the Iraqis develop democracy, and one hopes they will, it will be in spite of rather than because of what we have done.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Rashid Khalidi. He's professor at Columbia University, where he holds the Ed Said Chair in Arab Studies. He's also director of the Middle East Institute there at Columbia. He has authored a number of books about the Middle East, and his most recent is titled Resurrecting Empire. It's published by the Beacon Press. We have several people here who would like to talk, and so we didn't make that possible. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And actually, I think now the lines are full. So if you call, you'll get a busy signal. Do wait a little bit until we get a chance to talk with some of these folks. We'll start with a caller in Indiana. This is on our toll-free line, our line 4. Hello.
Hello. This question may be a little bit of far afield, but after some news I heard this morning, I had to find out something about it. Had to do with some prince in Saudi Arabia, I think it was Riyadh or something, was a close friend of the Bush family, and was going to do his best he could to get the oil production up so that it would help Bush win the election in November. Do you know anything about that or can give you any kind of historical insight of what's going on in this one? This one caught me far afield. Thanks a lot.
Sure. I think you're referring to a story this morning on National Public Radio, which I heard.
Yes.
Which referred to the report in the book by Woodward.
Right.
Reporting a conversation supposed to have taken place between, I believe, Prince Bandar al-Sultan, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, and the president or someone in the administration, in which the Saudi ambassador is supposed to have said that Saudi Arabia would help the president out towards election time by lowering prices. And what the person who was speaking on radio, and I think it was Yusuf Ibrahim, who's an oil analyst based in the Gulf, what he was saying, and I think he's right, is that even if Prince Bandar said that whenever Bob Woodward recorded it, maybe a year ago or 6 or 8 months ago, the Saudi royal family's position has changed, and other people in the royal family have different positions because they're so unhappy with American policy in Iraq, on Palestine, and generally speaking. Saudi Arabia is, in fact, trying to bring oil prices down because they're now, in some degree, out of control, and they're about to pump more than they've ever pumped in history. in order to bring more capacity onto the market. But a lot of analysts are saying that that might not be enough, that there's wild speculation going on. And even with Saudi Arabia at full capacity, because Venezuela and Iraq do not have the capability to pump as much as they sometimes have, and world oil demand just keeps going up, there may continue to be a shortage even after that, or at least prices will go up in response to a perception there's a shortage.
Yeah, the next quickie, and then I heard last few days that even if that production was increased, it's not sweet crude oil, but what they
right.
call sour crude, in which Americans don't have any refineries can handle it anyway.
Right, but still,
I wonder just, you know,
it'll be thrown onto the market, and the United States will be taking oil from West Africa or Latin America or somewhere else.
Thanks for straightening everything out.
It's true, the Saudi oil is not of the quality that American refineries usually use.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Let's go to Champagne next. Line one. Hello.
Yeah. I hope my question isn't too tangential. Torture and sexual abuse in prisons are not new to the Middle East. And there was torture by the French in Algeria, and there's torture of communists and Islamists and other groups, socialists in Egypt under Nasser and under Sadat and finally, you know, under Mubarak. And I know under Mubarak's regime, there was imprisonment and raping of militants' wives, Islamist militants' wives. Sexual abuse was kind of a policy. And I know that Israel has been involved in torturing Palestinians, and most probably, although I don't have any documentation, the reverse is true. But
Palestinians have been torturing other Palestinians. That's been documented.
Okay, all right. Yeah, that's true. I think I've read that.
In Palestinian prisons.
Right. And not to mention what's gone on with Saddam Hussein and the rape rooms, and then we have rape rooms again under American control. But I'm just wondering if you think the U.S. has learned anything from the French or later from the Egyptians and the Israelis and applied what they learned in Vietnam or in Iraq, or do you think that this is just something that arises in and of itself? Or is PsychOps actually taking information from, say, their interrogators that have been accused of rape, Egyptian interrogators, for example, that are working in Iraq?
I can't possibly answer that question. It's a very, very good question. I don't know. I mean, all the premises of the question are right. There has been torture in prisons across the Middle East during the colonial era. In the independent states, most, I think, of the independent states since the colonial era, and in Israeli prisons, and as I mentioned as well, in Palestinian prisons of Palestinian prisoners. I don't know where the special expertise in torture that's been deployed in these prisons has come from. What I do know is that some of this is clearly, from what I've been hearing from lawyers who've been talking to people in the Judge Advocate General Corps, what I've heard from journalists who have been digging into this, is that this is neither isolated nor abuse. This is systematic torture ordered at the highest levels on the basis of the experiences of Afghan and Qaeda detainees in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo, experiences with them. And those methods were imported into Iraq, apparently, according to one account I've heard, at the express order of the Secretary of Defense himself, though, again, that's just a report I've heard. I have no independent confirmation of that. But there's no question from many, many sources that the torture that is going on is intended to break people psychologically in order to render their interrogation more effective, and that is not being done by a few military police enlisted personnel. That's complete rubbish. And the sooner that story goes out the window, the better we all will be, because it's confronting what's really going on is going to involve accepting that way up in the chain of command, probably the civilian levels of the Pentagon, and certainly many higher military levels than have so far been mentioned, there was not just condoning of this, there were orders to do this.
Yeah, some of these practices are rather bizarre, to say the least, bizarre sexual practices, which seem almost, you know, less efficient than some very ugly torture techniques.
Let me interrupt you. Torture is not efficient. Torture produces whatever confession the torturer wants in most cases. There are two former detainees in Guantanamo whose British lawyers have brought suit in, I believe, in Britain, after they were released and on the basis of British intelligence showing the American interrogators that these men who had admitted under torture to having been in Afghanistan in a they were shown a video and said, "These are you guys. These are you two." A training in Afghanistan. They said, "No, we were in England." They were tortured. They said, "Okay, whatever you want, we'll sign it." They signed it. They admitted under torture that they had been present in a training camp in Afghanistan, even though they had sworn that they were in England at that time. And the British came in with incontrovertible evidence. British intelligence said, "These men were never in Afghanistan. We have proof from our own surveillance, apparently, that they were in England all the time." So torture never, never produces proper results. Torture always produces whatever the interrogators want, or if it produces anything, produces what the interrogators want, and mainly, I think, is intended to exercise power and inflict humiliation. It's a sick, obscene form of domination, and it's not surprising that it should be linked to sexual, that there should be sexual aspects to it.
Well, it seems that shame and humiliation are actually something that fuels terrorism. And maybe you can, that maybe will be the rest of some of the things you talk about it in terms of the Middle East reaction to colonialism or things of that nature. And Schwarzkopf himself said he was worried about Rumsfeld's kind of like bizarre pleasure in talking about some of the things that he was planning to do vis-a-vis the war.
Well, I don't want to get into the psychology of it, but I would say that an atmosphere of contempt for law, an atmosphere, a macho atmosphere that was created from the president and the secretary of defense on down, I think contributed to this. I don't know about the perverse psychosexual aspect of it, but I can tell you that the way in which law has been systematically trampled upon, whether the Geneva Conventions, whether international humanitarian law, whether the Uniform Code of Military Justice, has not just been something that we should all be ashamed of, it's something that in particular the military is outraged at, because leaving aside those soldiers and officers who participated in these barbaric practices, most military officers understand that American soldiers, if captured, require the protections of the Geneva Convention and other international law to protect them from this kind of humiliation. And in fact, Senator McCain himself, who as a prisoner in North Vietnam was tortured, said, "I was never humiliated in this way." And he therefore seems to believe, as do many military officers I've talked to, that the way in which the political leadership of the Pentagon and the way in which this administration have downgraded, eroded, and shown their utter contempt for international law is harmful to, among others, the U.S. military itself.
Let's continue. We have another caller. This is also Champagne, line number two.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if you'd address the role of oil and the dynamic of our involvement in Iraq and in the Middle East, and maybe particularly with respect to, like, you know, the neoconservative age, American age, and all that razzmatazz.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you have a thought about how dominant oil is in this equation? I mean, or just what your thoughts on that subject, perhaps?
I think that oil is one factor, and an important one. I try and argue in the book that there were a number of factors that explain this rush to war. One of them was a sort of strategic vision of the 21st century and of a United States unfettered by international law, by alliances, by the UN, able to act, to exercise its international power and weight. And I think the second element was oil. The idea that a very large part of the world's oil reserves lie in Iraq. It's the second largest proven reserves. But I believe that the people who are planning this war wanted to give the United States a privileged position vis-a-vis Middle East oil. So that was a factor. There were other factors, I think, as well.
To what extent do you think, if I can go on a little bit, to what extent do you think that they're driven by the fact that if we don't control the supply of oil to the Western economies, it's hard to visualize how we're going to get through the next 50 years, say? So do you think that they see it as an economic necessity?
Well, I mean, the thing that it's a little hard to understand what these people are going to do with this oil if they're not going to sell it to the West. So this idea of controlling oil is really a little bit of a myth. I mean, the oil producers need the consumers as much as the consumers need the producers.
Well,
So to some extent, it really is a matter of market share and whose corporations make the obscene profits on this, rather than are we going to have oil for our gas for our Hummers and our SUVs. we're going to have oil at a price. The only question will be the price, and control over the oil is not going to determine price. You can't force people to sell oil anymore, not in the 21st century, the way the oil companies did in the past, at prices determined by the United States rather than by the companies, rather than by the market. But I think they did want to give the United States a privileged position, not just in terms of Iraqi oil and possibly including the privatization of the Iraqi oil industry, but also in terms of all the other revenues that would accrue.
Could I make this finer, sort of a focus closer and say, like, to what extent do you think that the American oil industry and the profits you were just talking about,
the American oil
to what extent
industry
do they politically play a role, you know, in terms of our, in terms of moving us towards, like, this fiasco in Iraq?
I think it was a factor, a big factor. I mean, the people in this administration are many of them, from Condoleezza Rice to the president to Vice President Cheney, old oil hands. They've been deeply involved in the oil business. Condi has a tanker named for her. Halliburton is an oil company. It was the company that Cheney headed. The president himself owned independent oil companies. So we're talking about people for whom oil is very important, and so I do think it was a factor. I don't think it was the only or necessarily even the main factor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We are at our midpoint here, perhaps a little bit past. Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're talking with Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University, and before that, for a number of years, was at the University of Chicago, where he was Professor of Middle East History and also Director of the Center for International Studies. He's authored a number of books about the Middle East, many scholarly articles, and he's also contributed op-ed pieces to many national publications, including the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, The Nation, and he also has been widely interviewed on television and radio. His most recent book is titled Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East, which looks at the history of involvement in the politics of the Middle East of Western powers, particularly France and Britain, but also now more recently the United States, and is published by the Beacon Press. The lines here again are full, and so we'll continue to talk with callers. And next, someone in Milwaukee on line 3. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Professor Khalidi what he thinks of Ralph Nader's position for an orderly U.S. military withdrawal within the next 6 months.
I think the United States should leave as soon as possible. 6 months might be the right timing. I think that the American presence in Iraq is now a factor for insecurity and instability, and the United States is a target of hostility, and its removal from the scene will cause problems, but will probably resolve even larger problems. I'm not familiar with the details of Nader's proposal, but I have argued that the United States has to announce a date, that it should be much sooner than any of the dates that have been bandied about thus far, that it has to announce that it will not keep military bases in Iraq, that it has to announce that the measures to privatize, i.e. steal, the public assets of the Iraqi people, are going to have to be reversed. And that it will have to find a transitional mechanism involving, one hopes, the United Nations. I don't know much more about the details of the NATO proposal.
Yeah, I just basically wanted to get the thrust of your thinking about it. My own position is, with American ingenuity and air power, I think 4 months should be enough for an orderly withdrawal. But I'm glad to hear what you think about it. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
You're
so, Professor Kelly, when you're talking about U.S. revolver removal, withdrawal, you're talking about totally. You're talking about not just involvement in government, all the military forces that are there, all official involvement on that kind of a level. You're saying everybody should go.
I am talking about the viceroy, the 1,300 people who are going to be in the Viceroy Negroponte, who is supposed to be appointed the largest U.S. embassy. I'm talking about the apparatus of control that the United States has installed in Iraq and which it was intending to keep in Iraq after the so-called transfer of sovereignty, as well as the military forces. Unless a sovereign Iraqi government asks for them, or some of them, to stay, which I doubt will happen, but it may be possible as part of a different force.
I think that now, though, there are people, even people who would have said that initially, and now they did not support the idea of the war, who would say, though, that now that we've done what we've done, we're going to have to stay to try to guarantee some stability. And the concern would be that, for example, if our military forces withdrew, that we might imagine there could be a civil war, as the various sort of these three major parts that make up the country, the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds, start battling over territory and ultimately who's going to control the country and its resources.
Yeah, I'm not so sure there's going to be a civil war. I hope not. The strength of Iraqi nationalism is something that has been systematically denigrated by people who I don't think know a whole lot about Iraq, like Leslie Gelb, and who have been touting the idea of dividing Iraq up and partitioning it and so forth. I think that's a terrible idea. I don't think anybody should be advocating it. If it happens, it may be inevitable. If it happens, it's a regrettable fact, and it's going to cause long-term regional instability in every country of that region. And we will regret the day that if we did contribute to it, that we did contribute to it. I think that especially among the Sunni and Shia Iraqis, there's a shared sense of Iraqi nationhood. There is a serious difference with the Kurds. And it'll be very difficult to resolve that. But the problem for the Kurds is that if they don't resolve their differences with Baghdad, they're going to have bigger differences to resolve with Ankara, because the Turkish military in particular looks with a very, very wary eye on the idea of Kurdish independence in northern Iraq. And there's every likelihood of an intervention to prevent that, should that happen. So the Kurds may find themselves better off entering into some kind of weak federation, which is what they say they want, with the rest of Iraq. And the rest of the Iraqis may find that that's a doable thing. So I would not guarantee, I don't think there's necessarily going to be a civil war. There will be conflict within the communities in particular, notably among the Sunnis, among the Shia, to see who will dominate and which vision of Iraq will dominate. But that's natural at the end of a period of absolute dictatorship like that of Saddam Hussein. And we've maybe exacerbated those problems by what the United States has done. But in any case, I don't think America staying on will make those problems better.
Let's talk next with someone in Chicago, and that would be line number 4. Hello.
Hello. My first question is slightly personal. I wanted to know if you're related to the historians Walid and Tariq Khalidi.
Yes.
Okay. And then my second question is, what's your take on the CIA or the administration's turning on Shalabi? Is that just a put-up, or do you think that they really felt that he was double-dealing with Iran?
I don't know what is going on there for sure. I don't think it is entirely a put-up. Certainly there are at least two elements in the administration which have had their axes sharpened for Shalabi ever since he stole money from them. From us, I should say, the U.S. taxpayer. Accountants for the State Department and the CIA have found that large amounts of the tens of millions of dollars that his organization took in the late 90s could not be accounted for, i.e. was stolen, most likely. And so the State Department and the CIA have considered him a lying thief ever since the late 90s, when he claimed to be able to do things, couldn't do them, but pocketed the money, and then couldn't account for it. Or accounted for it in ways that were unacceptable. So they have had it in for him ever since the late 90s, and they were restrained by the heavy hand of the Pentagon, which has run most of the world, as you may have noticed. They've taken over the intelligence function, the diplomatic function, the AID function, the justice function in most of the world. And the rest of the administration was basically shriveling for the first 3 years of the Bush presidency. Now that the Pentagon has led us into the worst fiasco since Vietnam, it has lost its control over the situation in Iraq, and the other parts of the bureaucracy seem to be trying to take that back, and this, I think, is part of it. The issue of Iran, I find a little hard to understand. There is a piece in the New York Times today, obviously from intelligence sources, talking in detail about the leaking of classified materials and talking about an investigation into the individuals in the Pentagon who gave these classified materials to Chalabi for him, and which he then allegedly handed over to the Iranians. The Iranians in Chalabi have, of course, stoutly denied that there was any spying done. I don't know the truth of the matter.
Okay, and I have one last money question. Supposedly there's no accounting for the money that has been the result of the sales of Iraqi oil since the occupation. And also I found out in another news report that the assets of Saddam Hussein that were frozen are supposedly also now gone. Is one of the reasons why the United States is reluctant to share powers because they can't do any accounting for the funds?
Could be. There is a, I think it's called an accountability project, which the Open Society Institute has organized, trying to look into the spending of taxpayer funds, the billions of dollars that have been going into Iraq, and which apparently cannot be accounted for, in addition to Iraqi oil revenues, in addition to other funds. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
Frankly.
I just wanted to say thank you. I've been listening for you for years on Worldview, and
in
I'm
Chicago,
really
yeah.
sorry that you're no longer in Chicago and able to do regular shows.
Well, I was on Worldview on Friday, actually.
Yes, after a long, long time of not being on.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying listening to me.
Well, thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Let's go here to we have a caller in Belgium near Danville, nearby community. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I am in a quandary about a new name I've heard just very recently in this whole organization. And his name is Blackwell.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be between the person who the last called Shalaby talked about and Bustamante. There seems to be some kind of he's involved with these people somehow, but he's an American, and he deals with what the CIA and the all the vegetable soup names we've got, you know, involved with Iraq. Can you explain something about this fellow? I don't know anything about him.
This is a name that I myself have recently heard. He is apparently a presidential envoy. Who he is, I don't know.
So he's part of the Bush cabal.
Pardon me?
He's part of the Bush cabal.
Yeah, well, he may be one of the. I can't really answer your question. It's the first time I've heard the name is recently. He is deeply involved in this,
yeah.
And as I understand it, a presidential envoy.
Yes, that's the way I understand it too. And all of a sudden, he's just got in there and putting his fingers into it. And
right. I don't know where this person comes from. I don't recall him as being somebody from the State Department.
No, neither do I. And all of a sudden, just the last week or so, he's been showing up more and more.
Right.
And,
right.
What in the world is he going to get us into?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's continue. And I think our next caller is in Tolono, and that will be line number two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I was wondering, I don't know a whole lot about Islamic culture or the Iraqi versions of that, but it seemed to me that the odd and bizarre details that keep leaking out about exactly what kind of torture and abuse supposedly of the prisoners, it seems to me that a number of them seem to be pretty carefully tailored to particularly offend the Muslim sensibility. I remember seeing a photograph of a man being terrorized by a police dog, and I know that you know, anybody would say, gee, I don't want a police dog barking in my face. You're not there.
I'm there.
I'm sorry, we had a little problem because the phone line of the first caller didn't hang up like it should. That's where that signal was coming from. Now we've gotten rid of that, and we got, yes, okay. Yeah, we got you back now.
I saw the photographs of the man being terrorized by a police dog, but I know that in Muslim countries, oftentimes dogs are considered to be unclean, so it would be
like... In Islamic society, dogs are...
Islamic society,
right.
I'm sorry. And I know the nudity pictures. I always at the first time I heard the nudity, that so many of the photos were of nude people. I thought, well, that's really strange. What is this? You know, and then I realized, well, you know, showing one's body in Islamic societies is considered also so exceptionally more degrading than it would be in our society. Anyway, I wondered if you could give more details and speak more to that, please. And I'm going to have to hang up.
All right, thank you.
I can't give you much information on this. I think that it was believed by the interrogators who ordered this torture that these were things that would be particularly shaming to Muslims or to Arabs. Whether that's the case or not is another issue. I think, you know, the homosexual rape of young boys in front of the prisoners, which I understand was carried out behind a screen, but they could hear the boys screaming, groping of women, simulated sexual acts are things that probably would disturb anybody irrespective of their religion. I cannot imagine anybody, American, Belgian, Mozambican, whatever, responding positively to simulated homosexual rape or simulated whatever Maybe, though, I think this is true. Some of these things were believed by the interrogators to be particularly offensive to Muslims. For example, the use of dogs. I think anybody would be scared to have a snarling German shepherd snapping at them when they were naked. But it may be that people who don't have dogs as pets, which is generally the case in Islamic countries, and where dogs are considered unclean and therefore unfamiliar with them, would find it more terrifying. The only question, to my way of thinking, is who ordered all of this. It was ordered, obviously, at a higher level than some poor enlisted personnel in the military police. Whether there was a guiding intelligence behind it, and if so, whether that was based on expertise gained elsewhere. Some journalists have suggested that these are Israeli interrogation techniques. Others have suggested that these are techniques that were developed in Guantanamo, and there's apparently some evidence for that, for a meeting in Washington and sometime during the winter, this past winter, at which very high-ranking individuals are alleged to have ordered that the same techniques used in Guantanamo against Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees be used in Iraq. But those, to my way of thinking, are important questions about this apparently systematic use of torture.
Well, for what it's worth, and I don't know if you've read the reporting that Cy Hirsch has done. It's been published in The New Yorker. He says that apparently those people in Washington, including those people who were involved in planning for the Iraq invasion, were impressed by a book that was written by a cultural anthropologist who taught, among other places, at your own university there at Columbia, a man named Rafael Patai.
Yeah,
this is a
the
book
Arab
that
Mind.
The Arab Mind. It was first published in the early 1970s.
It's a piece of racist stereotyping of the worst sort.
I know only of it just because of this passing mention in the Hirsch article. And he said that it apparently stresses the idea that sex is a serious and difficult issue, and that it's a kind of thing that could be exploited.
Very, very possible.
Well, let's continue. I think we have another caller here, and that would be Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask another question about Chalabi, and that's that I understand Richard Perle's been a very big booster of his, and so has Bernard Lewis. And I'm just wondering, I guess, two things. One is, have you any insight as to why they focused on Chalabi so much? Because on the face of it, he doesn't seem like a very attractive, person to put into the fray there. And then, two, I was curious if you had any kind of critique about Bernard Lewis in general and his take on the Middle East, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
As far as Chalabi is concerned, I think the connection with Chalabi goes back to the University of Chicago, where he and Paul Wolfowitz were graduate students together. Wolfowitz in political science, studying with Leo Strauss and Albert Wallstetter, and Chalabi in mathematics. Their politics were the same as well. They both became much more conservative as they grew older. And they were buddies from way back when. This would be back in the 60s, I believe, early 60s, that the connection started. And Chalabi became the darling of the neoconservative set in Washington, from Richard Perle through Wolfowitz through a bunch of other people who had positions in the Reagan administration but have come into their own in this Bush administration. So that's the connection, and it is a very old personal one with a number of these people. And it became more important when Chalabi blotted his copybook with the CIA and the State Department, as I already talked about. Suddenly these people in the Vice President's office and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense became his main champions. In fact, as of until recently, his only champions in Washington. The other part of your question about Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis is a scholar who taught in London and then at Princeton, and he has become the guru. I write about him in the book, actually, briefly. There's a footnote. He was a great medievalist and a fine scholar of Islamic civilization about 1,000 years ago. He wrote about the assassins. He wrote about a number of things. And then later became an Ottomanist and did some interesting work on Turkey. But his expertise is neither the modern Middle East nor the Arab world. It's like saying somebody who's an expert on 12th century Belgium would talk to us about the European Union. And that's basically what we've got. We've got a man who is a great Islamicist, great Orientalist, great medievalist, pontificating about the Arabs today and democracy and things about which, unfortunately, he's never done any of his own research or has no personal knowledge. He's never lived in the Middle East. He's never worked, or certainly not in the Arab world, for extended periods of time. He's never done any research into these subjects. He's never written about them, except to recycle and rehash an interpretation which is essentially derived from his reading of medieval texts. There's an assessment of this culture and this civilization on the basis of 7th and 8th and 9th and 10th century texts, and an argument that essentially these people haven't changed. They always were this way. They always will be this way. And so it's a timeless, changeless, ahistorical view, which sees people responding to modernity and failing because they're stuck on a tradition that never changes. It's a view that no modern historians, very few modern historians subscribe to, as is his view of the interaction between the West and the Middle East. And I, for my own view on this, you should just look at my book. Lewis has his view. I have my view. It's a summary. It's just a short book, but I do try and argue against some of these interpretations in this book.
All right, let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, any time I think about Iraq and what's going on there, and I try to think about, you know, how it might resolve itself in the future. It seems the only thing I can ever envision there is just, you know, total chaos. And I think about, like, you know, Beirut, the way Beirut, Lebanon was a couple decades ago. And just, you know, like, I find it just very hard to imagine how things could possibly work themselves out with the current administration, the way it's, you know, pretty much not changing at all and just seeming to go against the rest of the world. I'm just wondering, is there any more positive outcome that you can envision? Is there any way that you can see, you know, things in Iraq actually resolving themselves and, you know, things somehow not working out, you know, quite so badly as they seem now?
Let me give a short answer to that question. Yes, I think they could work out better than the chaos that you foresee and I foresee. Unfortunately, I lived in Beirut from the late 60s until 1983, so I lived through the first half, more than the first half, of the Lebanese Civil War. And I don't wish that fate on the Iraqis or anybody else. And I hope that they will be able to avoid that. I've argued, and I would argue strongly, that there is a sense of Iraqi nationalism which might enable the Iraqis to avoid the very worst of this. It's manifested itself many times in the last few decades. You know, Iraq is always described as an artificial and recent state. Of course, it is artificial, and of course it is recent. I talk about those things in my book. But like 190 of the 200-odd countries in the world, it is also a country that has developed national identity over the last few generations. And in fact, it's had longer than many countries that became independent after World War II to do that. Most countries in the world weren't independent before World War II.
And you say they were or were not?
Pardon me?
They were or were not?
They were not.
Uh-huh.
The great wave of, you know, of independence movements taking and liberation movements establishing the freedom of Asian and African countries came after World War II. India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Burma, Indonesia, Malaysia, all the countries of Africa and most of the countries of the Middle East became independent after World War II. The vast majority of countries in the world, I think about three-quarters of them, became independent after World War II. Iraq was an independent country in 1932. So artificial though it is and recent though it is, it's had many, many generations in which to develop institutions of national life. And for all of the discrimination against Kurds over many regimes, the worst, of course, was the Saddam Hussein regime, but there was such discrimination under previous regimes. For all of the hegemony of the minority Sunnis over the state since the Ottoman times, there is an Iraqi nationalism, and there is a strong desire to avoid chaos on the part of most Iraqis. The question is, has this occupation, has the destruction of the state structure since the occupation began, has the heedless, callous folly of the people who've been administering Iraq exacerbated things such that it's going to be impossible to have a peaceful outcome. You know, a transition from dictatorship to democracy is hard anywhere. Look at Eastern Europe. It's not an easy thing to do. Look at many countries in Latin America where they've had hesitating but ultimately positive transitions over decades. It's going to take the Iraqis some time in the best of cases, and they're not in the best of cases. We've guaranteed that by the brainless actions of this administration in destroying something and not replacing it, and in having ideas taken from heaven knows what, but certainly not from an understanding of Iraqi history and the reality of that country, about what was to be done there. Those things have all exacerbated the situation, I think.
Well, thanks a lot for helping people understand that. I appreciate it.
Not at all.
Thank you for the call. Do you think that you've been critical of Middle East scholars, both because they don't often talk well to lay audiences and often that you say sometimes they just generally are interested in avoiding controversy and the
right.
difficult things.
They're afraid.
Do you think that's as much the case now as ever?
I think it is. I mean, there are a lot of people out there trying to intimidate anybody who expresses themselves on the Middle East, whether by calling them unpatriotic or by saying that they're biased insofar as Israel is concerned. And there are a bunch of intellectual thugs out there who really want to stifle debate certainly on Iraq, but also, I would argue, on many other aspects of the Middle East with those kinds of McCarthyite tactics. And for people who are tenured, you know, it shouldn't affect them. That's what tenure should be for, to give people the freedom to say things that are not necessarily conventional or not necessarily, you know, popular. I don't think that's the only problem, though. I think another problem is that academics tend to speak in jargon and tend to speak in terms of a vocabulary designed to appeal to a narrow audience rather than talking to ordinary people, which it should be part, in my view, should be part of their job. Hmm.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
It's a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Our guest, Rashid Khalidi, he is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. Before that, for a number of years, was at University of Chicago. His most recent book is Resurrecting Empire, and it is published by The Beacon Press. Our show, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Andy's Hallmark with cards, gift wrap, and candies, The Reading Group, a nonprofit clinic helping children and youth with reading and writing problems, on the web at readinggroup.org. The program today is also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to Third World artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Tomorrow morning on the program, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about third-party politics in America with Micah Sifry, former editor of The Nation, senior analyst at Public Campaign, author of the book Spoiling for a Fight, and then about corrections in America with Ellen Elsner. This is hour two. He's national correspondent for the Reuters News Agency, author of the book Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. I always welcome your calls. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon.